stolen from an Iqbal jam jar in a desperate attempt to buy a packet of fags. She felt an ache, like a severe malocclusion, the pressure of one tooth upon another, when she passed the park where they had cycled as children, where they smoked their first joint, where he had kissed her once in the middle of a storm. Irie wished she could give herself over to these past-present fictions, wallow in them, make them sweeter, longer, particularly the kiss. But she had in her hand a cold key, and surrounding her lives that were stranger than fiction, funnier than fiction, crueler than fiction, and with consequences fiction can never have. She didn't want to be involved in the long story of those lives, but she was. And she found herself dragged forward by the hair to their denouement, through the high road. Mally's Kebabs, Mr. Chung's, Raj's, Malkovich Bakeries. She could reel them off blindfold, and then down under Pigeon Ship Bridge and that long wide road that drops into Gladstone Park, as if it's falling into a green ocean. You could drown in memories like these, but she tried to swim free of them. She jumped over the small wall that fringed the Iqbal house, as she had a million times over, and rang the doorbell. Past tense, future imperfect. Upstairs, in his bedroom, Milat had spent the past 15 minutes trying to get his head around Brother Hifan's written instructions concerning the act of prostration. Leaflet, correct worship. Sajda. Prostration in the sajda. Fingers must be closed, pointing towards the Qibla in line with the ears, and the head must be between hands. It is far to put the forehead on something clean, such as a stone, some earth, wood, cloth, and it is said by savants that it is wajib to put the nose down too. It is not permissible to put only the nose on the ground without a good excuse. It is makrah to put only the forehead on the ground. In the sajda, you must say Subhana, Rabbia, Allah at least thrice. The Shi'is say that it is better to make the sajda on a brick made from the clay of Karbala. It is either fard or wajib to put 2 feet or at least one toe of each foot on the ground. There are also some savants who say that it is sunnat. That is, if 2 feet are not put on the ground, namaz will either not be accepted or it will become makrah. If, during the sajda, the forehead, nose or feet are raised from the ground for a short while, it will cause no harm. In the sajda, it is sunnat to bend the toes and turn them towards the Qibla. It is written in Rad al-Makta that those who say... That's as far as he got. And there were 3 more pages. He was in a cold sweat from trying to recall all that was halal or haram, fard or sunnat, makrah tarima, prohibited with much stress, or makrah tanziya, prohibited but to a lesser degree. At a loss, he had ripped off his t-shirt, tied a series of belts at angles over his spectacular upper body, stood in the mirror, and practiced a different, easier routine, one he knew in intimate detail. You looking at me? You looking at me? Well, who the fuck else are you looking at, huh? I can't see anybody else in here. You looking at me? He was in the swing of it, revealing his invisible sliding guns and knives to the wardrobe door when Irie walked in. Yes, said Irie as he stood there sheepish. I'm looking at you. Quickly and quietly she explained to him about the neutral place, about the room, about the date, about the time. She made her own personal plea for compromise, peace and caution. Everybody was doing it. And then she came up close and put the cold key in his warm hand. Almost without meaning to, she touched his chest, just at the point between 2 belts where his heart, constricted by the leather, beat so hard she felt it in her ear. Lacking experience in this field, it was natural that Irie should mistake the palpitations that come from blood restriction for smouldering passion. As for Milat, it had been a very long time since anybody touched him or he touched anybody. Add to that the touch of memory, the touch of 10 years of love unreturned, the touch of a long, long history, the result was inevitable. Before long their arms were involved, their legs were involved, their lips were involved, and they were tumbling onto the floor, involved at the groin, hard to get more involved than that, making love on a prayer mat. But then as suddenly and feverishly as it had begun, it was over. They released each other in horror for different reasons. Irie springing back into a naked huddle by the door, embarrassed and ashamed because she could see how much he regretted it, and Milat grabbing his prayer mat and pointing it towards the cover, ensuring the mat was no higher than floor level, resting on no books or shoes, his fingers closed and pointing to the Qibla in line with his ears, ensuring both forehead and nose touched the floor, with 2 feet firmly on the ground, but ensuring the toes were not bent, prostrating himself in the direction of the Kaaba, but not for the Kaaba, but for Allah Ta'ala alone. He made sure he did all these things perfectly, while Irie wept and dressed and left. He made sure he did all these things perfectly because he believed he was being watched by the great camera in the sky. He made sure he did all these things perfectly because they were fard. And he who wants to change worships becomes a disbeliever. Leaflet, The Straight Path. Hell hath no fury, etc., etc. Irie walked hot-faced from the Iqbal house and headed straight for the Chalfans with revenge on her mind. But not against Milat, rather in defense of Milat, for she had always been his defender, his blacky white knight. You see, Milat did not love her, and she thought Milat didn't love her because he couldn't. She thought he was so damaged he couldn't love anybody anymore. She wanted to find whoever had damaged him like this, damaged him so terribly, she wanted to find whoever had made him unable to love her. It's a funny thing about the modern world. You hear girls in the toilets of clubs saying, yeah, he fucked off and left me, he didn't love me, he just couldn't deal with love, he was too fucked up to know how to love me. Now how did that happen? What was it about this unlovable century that convinced us we were, despite everything, eminently lovable as a people, as a species? What made us think that anyone who fails to love us is damaged, lacking, malfunctioning in some way? And particularly if they replace us with a god or a weeping Madonna, or the face of Christ in a ciabatta role, then we call them crazy, deluded, regressive. We are so convinced of the goodness of ourselves and the goodness of our love, we cannot bear to believe that there might be something more worthy of love than us, more worthy of worship. Greetings cards routinely tell us everybody deserves love. No, everybody deserves clean water, not everybody deserves love all the time. Milat didn't love Irie. And Irie was sure there must be somebody she could blame for that. Her brain started ticking over. What was the root cause? Milat's feelings of inadequacy? What was the root cause of Milat's feelings of inadequacy? Majid. He had been born second because of Majid. He was the lesser son because of Majid. Joyce opened the door to her and Irie marched straight upstairs, maliciously determined to make Majid the second son for once, this time by 25 minutes. She grabbed him, kissed him, and made love to him angrily and furiously without conversation or affection. She rolled him around, tugged at his hair, dug what fingernails she had into his back, and when he came, she was gratified to note it was with a little sigh as if something had been taken from him. But she was wrong to think this a victory. It was simply because he knew immediately where she had been, why she was here, and it saddened him. For a long time they lay in silence together, naked, the autumn light disappearing from the room with every minute that passed. It seems to me, said Majid finally, as the moon became clearer than the sun, that you have tried to love a man as if he were an island, and you were shipwrecked and you could mark the land with an X. It seems to me it is too late in the day for all that. Then he gave her a kiss on the forehead that felt like a baptism, and she wept like a baby. 3 PM, 5th of November, 1992. The brothers meet, at last, in a blank room after a gap of 8 years and find that their genes, those prophets of the future, have reached different conclusions. Milat is astounded by the differences, the nose, the line of the jaw, the eyes, the hair. His brother is a stranger to him and he tells him so. Only because you wish me to be, says Majid with a crafty look. But Milat is blunt, not interested in riddles, and in a single shot asks and answers his own question. So you're going through with it, yeah? Majid shrugs. It is not mine to stop or start, brother, but yes, I intend to help where I can. It is a great project. It's an abomination. Leaflet, The Sanctity of Creation. Milat pulls out a chair from one of the desks and sits on it backwards, like a crab in a trap, legs and arms splayed either side. I see it rather as correcting the Creator's mistakes. The Creator doesn't make mistakes. So you mean to continue? You're damn right. And so do I. Well, that's it then, isn't it? It's already been decided. Kevin will do whatever is necessary to stop you and your kind, and that's the fucking end of it. But contrary to Milat's understanding, this is no movie and there is no fucking end to it, just as there is no fucking beginning to it. The brothers begin to argue. It escalates in moments and they make a mockery of that idea, a neutral place. Instead, they cover the room with history, past, present, and future history, for there is such a thing. They take what was blank and smear it with the stinking shit of the past like excitable, excremental children. They cover this neutral room in themselves, every gripe, the earliest memories, every debated principle, every contested belief. Milat arranges the chairs to demonstrate the vision of the solar system, which is so clearly and remarkably described in the Quran, centuries before Western science, leaflet, the Quran and the cosmos. Majid draws Pandey's parade, ground on one blackboard with a detailed reconstruction of the possible path of bullets, and on the other board a diagram depicting a restriction enzyme cutting neatly through a sequence of nucleotides. Milat uses the computer as television, a chalk rubber as the picture of Majid and Goat, then single-handedly impersonates every dribbling Baba, great-aunt and cousin's accountant who came that year for the blasphemous business of worshipping an icon. Majid utilizes the overhead projector to illuminate an article he has written, taking his brother point by point through his argument, defending the patents of genetically altered organisms. Milat uses the filing cabinet as a substitute for another one he despised, fills it with imaginary letters between a scientist Jew and an unbelieving Muslim. Majid puts three chairs together and shines two angle-poised lamps, and now there are two brothers in a car, shivering and huddled together until a few minutes later they are separated forever and a paper plane takes off. It goes on and on and on. And it goes to prove what has been said of immigrants many times before now. They are resourceful. They make do. They use what they can when they can. Because we often imagine that immigrants are constantly on the move, footloose, able to change course at any moment, able to employ their legendary resourcefulness at every turn. We have been told of the resourcefulness of Mr. Schmutters or the footloosity of Mr. Banerjee, who sail into Ellis Island or Dover or Calais and step into their foreign lands as blank people, free of any kind of baggage, happy and willing to leave their difference at the docks and take their chances in this new place, merging with the oneness of this green and pleasant libertarian land of the free. Whatever road presents itself, they will take. And if it happens to lead to a dead end, well then, Mr. Schmutters and Mr. Banerjee will merrily set upon another, weaving their way through happy multicultural land. Well, good for them. But Majid and Milat couldn't manage it. They left that neutral room as they had entered it, weighed down, burdened, unable to waver from their course or in any way change their separate, dangerous trajectories. They seem to make no progress. The cynical might say they don't even move at all, that Majid and Milat are two of Zeno's headfuck arrows, occupying a space equal to themselves and, what is scarier, equal to Mangal Pandey's, equal to Samad Iqbal's, two brothers trapped in the temporal instant. Two brothers who pervert all attempts to put dates to this story, to track these guys, to offer times and days because there isn't, wasn't, and never will be any duration. In fact, nothing moves. Nothing changes. They are running at a standstill. Zeno's paradox. But what was Zeno's deal here? Everybody's got a deal. What was his angle? There is a body of opinion that argues his paradoxes are part of a more general spiritual program. To A, first establish multiplicity, the many, as an illusion, and B, thus prove reality a seamless flowing whole. A single, indivisible one. Because if you can divide reality inexhaustibly into parts, as the brothers did that day in that room, the result is insupportable paradox. You are always still, you move nowhere, there is no progress. But multiplicity is no illusion, nor is the speed with which those in the simmering melting pot are dashing towards it. Paradoxes aside, they are running just as Achilles was running. And they will lap those who are in denial just as surely as Achilles would have made that tortoise eat his dust. Yeah, Zeno had an angle. He wanted the one, but the world is many. And yet still that paradox is alluring. The harder Achilles tries to catch the tortoise, the more eloquently the tortoise expresses its advantage. Likewise, the brothers will race towards the future, only to find they more and more eloquently express their past, that place where they have just been. Because this is the other thing about immigrants. Fugees, emigre, travellers. They cannot escape their history any more than you yourself can lose your shadow. 18. The end of history versus the last man. Look around you, and what do you see? What is the result of this so-called democracy, this so-called freedom, this so-called liberty? Oppression, persecution, slaughter. Brothers, you can see it on national television every day, every evening, every night. Chaos, disorder, confusion. They are not ashamed or embarrassed or self-conscious. They don't try to hide, to conceal, to disguise. They know, as we know, the entire world is in a turmoil. Everywhere, men indulge in prurience, promiscuity, profligacy, vice, corruption, and indulgence. The entire world is affected by a disease known as kuf, the state of rejection of the oneness of the Creator, refusing to acknowledge the infinite blessings of the Creator, and on this day, the 1st of December 1992, I bear witness that there is nothing worthy of worship besides the sole Creator, no partner unto him. On this day we should know that whosoever the Creator has guided cannot be misguided, and whosoever he has misguided from the straight path shall not return to the straight path until the Creator puts guidance in his heart and brings him to the light. I will now begin my third lecture, which I call Ideological Warfare, and that means I will explain for those that don't understand the war of these things, these ideologies against the brothers of Kevin. Ideology means a kind of brainwashing, and we are being indoctrinated, fooled and brainwashed, my brothers. So I will try to elucidate, explain and expound. No one in the hall was going to admit it, but Brother Ibrahim ad-Din Shukrullah was no great speaker, when you got down to it. Even if you overlooked his habit of using three words where one would do, of emphasizing the last word of such triplets with his seesaw Caribbean inflections, even if you ignored these as everybody tried to, he was still physically disappointing. He had a small sketchy beard, a hunched demeanour, a repertoire of tense, inept gesticulations, and a vague look of Sidney Poitier about him which did not achieve quite the similitude to command any serious respect. And he was short. On this point, Milat felt most let down. There was a tangible dissatisfaction in the hall when Brother Hifan finished his fulsome introductory speech and the famous but diminutive Brother Ibrahim ad-Din Shukrullah crossed the room to the podium. Not that anyone would require an alim of Islam to be a towering height or indeed for a moment dare to suggest that the Creator had not made Brother Ibrahim ad-Din Shukrullah precisely the height that he, in all his holy omnipotence, had selected. Still, one couldn't help thinking, as Hifan awkwardly lowered the microphone and the Brother Ibrahim awkwardly stretched to meet him, you couldn't help thinking, in the brother's very own style of third word emphasis, 5'5". The other problem with Brother Ibrahim ad-Din Shukrullah, the biggest problem perhaps, was his great affection for tautology. Though he promised explanation, elucidation and exposition, linguistically, he put one in mind of a dog chasing its own tail. Now, there are many types of warfare. I will name a few. Chemical warfare is the warfare where them men kill each other chemically with warfare. This can be a terrible warfare. Physical warfare. That is the warfare with physical weapons in which people kill each other physically. Then there is germ warfare in which a man, he knows that he's carrying the virus of HIV, and he goes to the country and spreads his germ on the loose women of that country and creates germ warfare. Psychological warfare, that is one of the most evil. The war where they try to psychologically defeat you. This is called psychological warfare. But ideological warfare, that is a sixth warfare, which is the worst warfare. And yet Brother Ibrahim ad-Din Shukrullah was no less than the founder of Kevin, an impressive man with a formidable reputation. Born Monty Clyde Benjamin in Barbados in 1960, the son of two poverty-stricken barefoot Presbyterian dipsomaniacs, he converted to Islam after a vision at the age of 14. Aged 18, he fled the lush green of his homeland for the desert surrounding Riyadh and the books that line the walls of Al-Imam Muhammad ibn Saud Islamic University. There he studied Arabic for 5 years, became disillusioned with much of the Islamic clerical establishment, and first expressed his contempt for what he called religious secularists, those foolish ulama who attempt to separate politics from religion. It was his belief that many radical modern political movements were relevant to Islam and moreover were to be found in the Quran if one looked closely enough. He wrote several pamphlets on this matter, only to find that his own radical opinions were not welcome in Riyadh. He was considered a troublemaker, and his life threatened numerous countless innumerable times. So in 1984, wishing to continue his study, Brother Ibrahim came to England, locked himself in his aunt's Birmingham garage, and spent 5 more years in there, with only the Quran and the fascicles of endless bliss for company. He took his food in through the cat flap, deposited his shit and piss in a coronation biscuit tin, and passed it back out the same way, and did a thorough routine of press-ups and sit-ups to prevent muscular atrophy. The Selly Oak reporter wrote regular bylines on him during this period, nicknaming him the Guru in the Garage, in view of the large Birmingham Muslim population. This was thought preferable to the press desk-favoured suggestion, the loony in the lock-up, and had their fun interviewing his bemused aunt, one Carlene Benjamin, a devoted member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. These articles, cruel, mocking and offensive, had been written by one Norman Henshall, and were now classics of their kind, distributed amongst Kevin members throughout England as an example, if example were needed, of the virulent anti-Kevin element that bred in the press from even this fetal stage of their movement. Note, Kevin members were advised. Note how Henshall's articles end halfway through May 87, the very month that Brother Ibrahim ad-Din Shukrullah succeeded in converting his Aunt Carlene through the cat flap using nothing else but the pure truth as it was delivered by the final prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Note how Henshall fails to document the queues of people who came to speak with Brother Ibrahim ad-Din Shukrullah. So many they stretched 3 blocks round the centre of Selly Oak, from the cat flap to the bingo hall. Note the failure of this same Mr. Henshall to publish the 637 separate rules and laws that the brother had spent 5 years gleaning from the Quran, listing them in order of severity and then in subgroups according to their nature, i.e. regarding cleanliness and specific genital and oral hygiene. Note all this, brothers and sisters, and then marvel at the power of word of mouth. Marvel at the dedication and commitment of the young people of Birmingham. Their eagerness and enthusiasm was so remarkable, extraordinary, outstanding, unprecedented, that almost before the brother emerged from his confinement and announced it himself, the idea of Kevin had been born within the black and Asian community. A radical new movement where politics and religion were two sides of the same coin. A group that took freely from Garveyism, the American civil rights movement and the thought of Elijah Muhammad, yet remained within the letter of the Quran. The keepers of the eternal and victorious Islamic nation. By 1992, they were a small but widespread body, with limbs as far flung as Edinburgh and Land's End, a heart in Selly Oak and a soul in the Kilburn High Road. Kevin, an extremist faction dedicated to direct, often violent action, a splinter group frowned on by the rest of the Islamic community, popular with the 16 to 25 age group, feared and ridiculed in the press, and gathered tonight in the Kilburn Hall, standing on chairs and packed to the rafters, listening to the speech of their founder. There are 3 things, continued Brother Ibrahim, looking briefly at his notes, that the colonial powers wish to do to you, brothers of Kevin. Firstly, they wish to kill you spiritually. Oh yes, they value nothing higher than your mental slavery. There are too many of you to fight hand to hand. But if they have your minds, then... Hey! When a fat man's attempt to a whisper, Brother Millat. It was Muhammad Hussein Ishmael, the butcher. He was sweating profusely as ever, and had forced his way through a long line of people apparently to sit next to Millat. They were distantly related, and these past few months Mo had been rapidly nearing the inner circle of Kevin, Hifan, Millat, Tyrone, Shiva, Abdul Colin, and others, by virtue of the money he had put forward and his stated interest in the more active sides of the group. Personally, Millat was still a little suspicious of him and objected to his big slobbery face, the great quiff emerging from his toki and his chicken breath. Late. I have to close up shop. But I've been standing at the back for a while listening. Brother Ibrahim is a very impressive man, Very impressive, repeated Mo, patting Millat's knee conspiratorially. A very impressive brother. Mo Hussein was partly funding Brother Ibrahim's tour around England, so it was in his interest, or at least it made him feel better, about donating 2,000 quid to find the brother impressive. Mo was a recent convert to Kevin. He had been a reasonably good Muslim for 20 years, and his enthusiasm for the group was two-pronged. Firstly, he was just flattered, downright flattered, that he should be considered sufficiently successful a Muslim businessman to ponce money off. In normal circumstances, he would have shown them the door and where they could stuff a freshly bled chicken, but the truth was, Mo was feeling a bit vulnerable at the time. His stringy-legged Irish wife, Sheila, having just left him for a publican, he was feeling a little emasculated, so when Kevin asked Ardashia for $5,000 and got it, and Nadir for the rival halal place put up three, Mo came over all macho and put up his own stake. The second reason for Mo's conversion was more personal. Violence. Violence and theft. For 18 years, Mo had owned the most famous halal butchers in North London. So famous that he'd been able to buy the next door property and expand into a sweet shop stroke butchers. And in this period in which he ran the two establishments, he had been a victim of serious physical attacks and robbery, without fail, three times a year. Now that figure doesn't include the numerous punches to the head, quick smacks with a crowbar, shifty kicks in the groin, or anything else that failed to draw blood. Mo didn't even phone his wife, no matter the police, to report those. No. Serious violence. Mo had been knifed a total of five times. Ah. Lost the tips of three fingers. Eesh. Had both legs and arms broken. Ow. His feet set on fire. Gee. His teeth kicked out. Katoof. And an air gun bullet. Ping. Embedded in his thankfully fleshy posterior. Boof. And Mo was a big man. A big man with attitude. The beatings had in no way humbled him, made him watch his mouth or walk with a stoop. He gave as good as he got. But this was one man against an army. There was nobody who could help. The very first time when he received a hammer blow to his ribs in January 1970, he naively reported it to the local constabulary and was rewarded by a late-night visit from five policemen who gave him a thorough kicking. Since then, violence and theft had become a regular part of his existence, a sad spectator sport watched by the old Muslim men and young Muslim mothers who came to buy their chicken and hurried out shortly afterwards, scared they might be next. Violence and theft. The culprits ranged from secondary school children coming in the corner shop side to buy sweets, which is why Mo only allowed one child from Glenard Oak in at a time. Of course it made no difference, they just took turns beating the shit out of him solo. Decrepit drunks, teenage thugs, the parents of teenage thugs, general fascists, specific neo-Nazis, the local snooker team, the darts team, the football team, and huge posses of mouthy white skirted secretaries in deadly heels. These various people had various objections to him. He was a packy. Try telling a huge drunk office super world checkout boy that you're Bangladeshi. He gave half his corner shop up to selling weird packy meat. He had a quiff. He liked Elvis. You like Elvis then, do ya? Eh, packy, do ya? The price of his cigarettes. His distance from home. Why don't you go back to your own country? But then how will I serve you cigarettes? Boof. Or just a look on his face. But they all had one thing in common, these people. They were all white. And this simple fact had done more to politicize Mo over the years than all the party broadcasts, rallies and petitions the world could offer. It brought him more securely within the fold of his faith than even a visitation from the angel Jibreel could have achieved. The last straw, if it could be called that, came a month before joining Kevin, when three white youths tied him up, kicked him down the cellar steps, stole all his money and set fire to his shop. Double-jointed hands, the result of many broken wrists, got him out of that one, but he was tired of almost dying. When Kevin gave Mo a leaflet that explained there was a war going on, he thought, no shit. At last someone was speaking his language. Mo had been in the front line of that war for 18 years, and Kevin seemed to understand that it wasn't enough. His kids doing well, going to a nice school, having tennis lessons, too pale-skinned to ever have a hand laid on them in their lives. Good. But not good enough. He wanted a little payback for himself. He wanted Brother Ibrahim to stand on that podium and dissect Christian culture and Western morals until it was dust in his hands. He wanted the degenerate nature of these people explained to him. He wanted to know the history of it and the politics of it and the root cause. He wanted to see their art exposed and their science exposed and their tastes exposed and their distastes. But words would never be enough. He'd heard so many words. If you could just file a report, if you wouldn't mind telling us precisely what the attacker looked like, and they were never as good as action. He wanted to know why these people kept on beating the shit out of him, and then he wanted to go and beat the shit out of some of these people. Very impressive, Millat. Hey, everything we hope for. Yeah, said Millat, despondent. I suppose. Less talk, more action, though, if you ask me. The infidel were everywhere. Mo nodded vigorously. Oh, definitely, brother. We are two birds from the same bush on that matter. I hear there are some others, said Mo, lowering his voice and putting his fat, sweaty lips by Millat's ear, who are very keen on action. Immediate action. Brother Hifan spoke to me about the 31st of December, and Brother Shiva and Brother Tyrone. Yes, yes, I know who they are. They are the beating heart of Kevin. And they say you know the man himself, this scientist, you in good position. I hear you are his friend. Was. Was. Brother Hifan says you have the tickets to get in, that you are organizing. Shh, said Millat irritably. Not everyone can know. If you want to get near the center, you've got to keep shtum. Millat looked Mo up and down, the Kurta pajamas that he somehow managed to make look like a 70s Elvis flared jumpsuit. The huge stomach he rested on his knee like a friend. Sharply he asked, you're a bit old, aren't you? You rude little bastard. I'm as strong as a bloody bull. Yeah, well, we don't need strength, said Millat, tapping his temple. We need a little of the stuff upstairs. We've got to get in the place discreetly first, innit? The first evening, it'll be crawling. Mo blew his nose in his hand. I can be discreet. Yeah, but that means keeping shtum. And the third thing, said Brother Ibrahim ad-Din Shukrullah, interrupting them, suddenly louder and buzzing the PA system, the third thing they will try to do is to convince you that it is human intellect and not Allah that is omnipotent, unlimited, all-powerful. They will try to convince you that your minds are not to be used to pronounce the greater glory of the Creator, but to raise yourselves up equal to or beyond the Creator. And now we approach the most serious business of this evening. The greatest evil of the infidel is here, in this very borough of Brent. I will tell you, and you will not believe it, brothers, but there is a man in this very community who believes that he can improve upon the creation of Allah. There is a man who presumes to change, adjust, modify what has been decreed. He will take an animal that Allah has created, and presume to change that creation, to create a new animal that has no name but is simply an abomination. And when he has finished with that small animal, a mouse, brothers, when he has finished, he will move to sheep and cats and dogs. And who in this lawless society will stop him from one day creating a man? A man born not of woman, but from a man's intellect alone. And he will tell you that it is medicine. But Kevin makes no complaint against medicine. We are a sophisticated community who count many doctors amongst us, my brothers. Don't be misled, deluded, fooled. This is not medicine. And my question to you, brothers of Kevin, is who will make the sacrifice and stop this man? Who will stand up alone in the name of the Creator and show the modernists that the Creator's laws still exist and are eternal? Because they will try and tell you, the modernists, the cynics, the orientalists, that there are no more beliefs, that our history, our culture, our world is over. So thinks this scientist. That is why he so confidently presumes. But he will soon understand what is truly meant by last days. So who will show him? Yes, Shtum, yes, I understand, said Mo, speaking to Millat, but looking straight ahead as in a spy movie. Millat looked around the room and saw that Hifan was giving him the eye, so he gave it to Shiva, who gave it to Abdul Jimmy and Abdul Colin, to Tyrone and the rest of the Kilburn crew, who were stationed by the walls as stewards at particular points in the room. Hifan gave Millat the eye once more, then he looked at the back room. Discreet movement began. Something is happening, whispered Mo, spotting the men with the green steward sashes, making their way through the crowds. Come into the office, said Millat. Okay, so I think the key thing here is to come at the issue from two sides, because it is a matter of straight laboratory torture, and we can certainly play that to the gallery. But the central emphasis has to go to the anti-patent argument, because that's really an angle we can work. and if we lay our emphasis there, then there are a number of other groups we can call upon. The NCGA, the OHNO, etc. And Crispin's been in touch with them. Because, you know, we really haven't dealt in this area extensively before, but it's clearly a key issue. I think Crispin's going to talk to us about that in more depth in a minute. But for now, I just want to talk about the public support we have here. I mean, particularly the recent press. Even the tabloid element have really come up trumps on this. There's a lot of bad feeling regarding the patenting of living organisms. I think people feel very uncomfortable, rightly, with that concept, and it's really up to fate to play on that and really get a comprehensive campaign together. So if... Ah, Jolie. Jolie, Jolie, Jolie. Joshua knew he should be listening, but looking was so good. Looking at Jolie was great. The way she sat on a table, knees pulled up to chest. The way she looked up from her notes, kittenishly. The way the air whistled between her gappy front teeth. The way she continuously tucked her straggly blonde hair behind her ear with one hand and tapped out a rhythm on her huge Doc Martens with the other. Blonde hair aside, she looked a lot like his mother when young, those fulsome English lips, ski jump nose, big hazel eyes, but the face, spectacular as it might be, was mere decoration to top off the most luxurious body in the world. Long in all its lines, muscular in the thigh and soft in the stomach. With breasts that had never known a bra, but were an utter delight. And a bottom which was the platonic ideal of all English bottomry. Flat yet peachy, wide but welcoming. Plus she was intelligent. Plus she was devoted to her cause. Plus she despised his father. Plus she was 10 years older, which suggested to Joshua all kinds of sexual expertise. He couldn't even imagine without getting an enormous hard-on right now, right here in the middle of the meeting. Plus she was the most wonderful woman Joshua had ever met. Oh, Jolie. As I see it, what we have to impress upon people is this idea of setting a precedent. You know, the what's next kind of argument. And I understand Kenny's POV, that that's way too simplistic a take on it. But I have to argue, I think it's necessary. And we'll put it to a vote in a minute. Is that all right, Kenny? If I can just get on, right? Right. Where was I? Precedent. Because if it can be argued that the animal under experimentation is owned by any group of people, i.e. it is not a cat but effectively an invention with cat-like qualities, then that very cleverly and very dangerously short-circuits the work of animal rights groups, and that leads to a pretty fucking scary vision of the future. I want to bring Crispin in here to talk a little more about that. Of course, the cunt of it was, Jolie was married to Crispin. And a double cunt of it was theirs was a marriage of true love, total spiritual bonding, and dedicated political union. Fan-fucking-tastic. Even worse, amongst the members of Fate, Jolie's and Crispin's marriage served as a kind of cosmogony, an originating myth that explains succinctly what people could and should be, how the group began, and how it should proceed in the future. Though Jolie and Crispin didn't encourage ideas of leadership or any kind of icon worship, it happened anyway. They were worshipped. And they were indivisible. When Joshua first joined the group, he had tried to sniff out a little information on the couple, get the lowdown on his chances. Were they wobbly? Had the harsh nature of their business driven them apart? Fat chance. He was told the whole depressing fable by two seasoned Fate activists over some pints in the Spotted Dog. A psychotic ex-postal worker called Kenny, who, as a child, had witnessed his father kill his puppy, and Paddy, a sensitive lifetime doll collector and pigeon fancier. Everyone begins wanting to shag Jolie, Kenny had explained, sympathetically. But you get over it. You realize the best thing you can do for her is dedicate yourself to the struggle. And then the second thing you realize is that Crispin's just this incredible dude. Yeah, yeah, get on with it. Kenny got on with it. It seemed Jolie and Crispin met and fell in love at the University of Leeds the winter of 1982. Two young student radicals with Che Guevara on their walls, idealism in their hearts and a mutual passion for all the creatures that fly, trot, crawl and slime across the earth. At the time, they were both active members of a great variety of far-left groups, but political infighting, backstabbing and endless factionalizing soon disillusioned them as far as the fate of Homo erectus was concerned. At some point, they grew tired of speaking up for this species of ours who will so often organize a coup, bitch behind your back, choose another representative and throw it all back in your face. Instead, they turned their attention to our mute animal friends. Jolie and Crispin upgraded their vegetarianism to veganism, dropped out of college, got married, and formed Fighting Animal Torture and Exploitation in 1985. Crispin's magnetic personality and Jolie's natural charm attracted other political drifters, and soon they had become a commune of 25 plus 10 cats, 14 dogs, a garden full of wild rabbits, a sheep, two pigs, and a family of foxes, living and working from a Brixton bedsit which backed onto a large expanse of unused allotment. They were pioneers in many senses, recycling before it became the fashion, making a tropical biosphere of their sweaty bathroom, and dedicating themselves to organic food production. Politically, they were equally circumspect. From the very beginning, their extremist credentials were impeccable, fate being to the RSPCA what Stalinism is to the Liberal Democrats. For 3 years, fate conducted a terror campaign against animal testers, torturers, and exploiters, sending death threats to personnel at makeup firms, breaking into labs, kidnapping technicians, and chaining themselves to hospital gates. They also ruined fox hunts, filmed battery chickens, burnt down farms, firebombed food outlets, and smashed up circus tents. Their brief being so broad and so fanatical, any animal in any level of discomfort, they were kept seriously busy, and life for fate members was difficult, dangerous, and punctuated by frequent imprisonment. Through all of this, Jolie and Crispin's relationship grew stronger, and served as an example to them all, a beacon in the storm, the ideal example of love between activists. Yada, 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 get on with it. Then in 1987, Crispin went to jail for 3 years for his part in firebombing a Welsh laboratory and releasing 40 cats, 350 rabbits, and 1,000 rats from their captivity. Before being taken down to Wormwood Scrubs, Crispin generously informed Jolie that she had his permission to go to other fate members if she was in need of sexual satisfaction while he was gone. And did she? Asked Joshua. Did she fuck? Replied Kenny sadly. During Crispin's captivity, Jolie devoted herself to transforming fate from a small gang of highly strung friends to a viable underground political force. She began to put less emphasis on terror tactics, and after reading Guy Debord, grew interested in situationism as a political tactic, which she understood to mean the increased use of large banners, costumes, videos, and gruesome reenactments. By the time Crispin emerged from jail, fate had grown fourfold, and Crispin's legend, lover, fighter, rebel, hero, had grown with it. Fueled by Jolie's passionate interpretation of his life and works and a carefully chosen photo of him circa 1980, in which he looked a bit like Nick Drake. But though his image had been airbrushed, Crispin appeared to have lost none of his radicalism. His first act as a free citizen was to mastermind the release of several hundred voles, an event that received widespread newspaper coverage. Though Crispin delegated responsibility for the actual act to Kenny, who was sent down for 4 months of high security, greatest moment of my life. And then last summer, 91, Jolie persuaded Crispin to go to California with her to join the other groups fighting the patent on transgenic animals. Though courtrooms weren't Crispin's scene, Crispin's a front-line dude, he succeeded in sufficiently disrupting proceedings to officially warrant a mistrial. The couple flew back to England, elated, but with funds perilously low, to find they had been turfed out of their Brixton pad and, well, Joshua could take the narrative from here. He met them a week later, wandering up and down the Willesden High Road, looking for a suitable squat. They looked lost, and Joshua, emboldened by the summer vibe and Jolie's beauty, went up to talk to them. They ended up going for a pint. They drank, as everybody in Willesden drank, in the aforementioned Spotted Dog, a famous Willesden landmark, described in 1792 as being a well-accustomed public house. Willesden Past by Len Snow, which became a favourite resort for mid-Victorian Londoners wishing a day out in the country. Then the meeting point for the horse buses, later still a watering hole for local Irish builders. By 1992 it had transformed again, this time into the focal point of the huge Australian immigrant population of Willesden, who for the last 5 years had been leaving their silky beaches and emerald seas and inexplicably arriving in NW2. The afternoon Joshua walked in with Jolie and Crispin, this community was in a state of high excitement. After a complaint of a terrible smell above Sister Mary's palm readers on the high road, the upper flat had been raided by health officers and found to be sheltering 16 squatting Aussies who had dug a huge hole in the floor and roasted a pig in there, apparently trying to recreate the effect of a South Seas underground kiln. Thrown out on the street, they were presently bemoaning their fate to the publican, a huge bearded Scotsman, who had little sympathy for his Antipodean clientele. Is there some fucking sign in fucking Sydney that says come to fucking Willesden? Overhearing the story, Joshua surmised the flat must now be empty and took Jolie and Crispin to look at it, his mind already ticking over. If I can get her to live nearby. It was a beautiful crumbling Victorian building, with a small balcony, a roof garden and a large hole in the floor. He advised them to lie low for a month and then move in. They did, and Joshua saw more and more of them. A month later he experienced a conversion after hours of talk with Jolie, hours of examining her breasts underneath those threadbare t-shirts, which felt, at the time, as if somebody had taken his little closed chauvinist head, stuck two cartoon sticks of dynamite through each ear, and just blown a big motherfucking hole in his consciousness. It became clear to him in a blinding flash that he loved Jolie, that his parents were assholes, that he himself was an asshole, and that the largest community of Earth, the animal kingdom, were oppressed, imprisoned, and murdered on a daily basis with the full knowledge and support of every government in the world. How much of the last realization was predicated and reliant upon the first was difficult to say, but he had given up chauvinism and had no interest in taking things apart to see how they fitted together. Instead, he gave up all meat, ran off to Glastonbury, got a tattoo, became the kind of guy who could measure an eighth with his eyes closed. So fuck you, Milat. And generally had a ball. Until finally his conscience pricked him. He revealed himself to be the son of Marcus Chalfin. This horrified Jolie, and, Joshua liked to think, slightly aroused her, sleeping with the enemy and all that. Joshua was sent away, while Fate had a 2-day summit meeting along the lines of, but he's the very thing we're... Ah, but we could use... It was a protracted process with votes and subclauses and objections and provisos. But in the end, it couldn't really come down to anything more sophisticated than, whose side are you on? Joshua said yours, and Jolie welcomed him with open arms, pressing his head to her exquisite bosom. He was paraded at meetings, given the role of secretary, and was generally the jewel in their crown, the convert from the other side. Since then, and for 6 months, Joshua had indulged his growing contempt for his father, seen plenty of his great love, and set about a long-term plan of insinuating himself between the famous couple. He needed somewhere to stay anyway, the Joneses' hospitality was growing thin. He ingratiated himself with Crispin, deliberately ignoring Crispin's suspicion of him. Joshua acted like his best mate, did all the shit jobs for him, photocopying, postering, leafleting, kipped on his floor, celebrated his 7th wedding anniversary, and presented him with a handmade guitar plectrum for his birthday, while all the time hating him intensely, coveting his wife as no man's wife has ever been coveted before, and dreaming up plots for his downfall with a green-eyed jealousy that would make Iago blush. All this had distracted Joshua from the fact that Fate were busy plotting his own father's downfall. He had approved it in principle when Majid returned, when his rage was hottest and the idea itself seemed hazy. Just some big talk to impress new members. Now the 31st was 3 weeks away, and Joshua had so far failed to question himself in any coherent way, in any chauvinist fashion, regarding the consequences of what was about to happen. He wasn't even clear precisely what was going to happen. There had been no final decision, and now, as they argued it, the core members of Fate, cross-legged and spaced out around the great hole in the floor, now, as he should have been listening to these fundamental decisions, he had lost the thread of his attention down Jolie's t-shirt, down along the athletic dip and curve of her torso, down further to her tie-dyed pants, down. Josh, mate, could you just read me the minutes for a couple of minutes ago, if you get my drift, huh? Crispin sighed and tutted. Jolie reached down from her tabletop and kissed Crispin on the ear. Cunt. The minutes, Josh. After the stuff Jolie was saying about protest strategy. We'd moved on to the hard part. I want to hear what Paddy was saying a few minutes ago about punishment versus release. Joshua looked at his blank clipboard and placed it over his detrimescent erection. I guess I missed that. Well, that was actually really fucking important, Josh. You've got to keep up. I mean, what's the point of doing all this talking? cunt, cunt, cunt. He's doing his best, Jolie interceded, reaching down from her tabletop once more, this time to ruffle Joshua's jufro. This is probably quite hard for Joshy, you know? I mean, this is quite personal to him. She always called him Joshy, like that. Joshy and Jolie, Jolie and Joshy. Crispin frowned. Well, you know, I've said many times, if Joshua doesn't want to be personally involved in this job because of personal sympathies, if he wants out, then... I'm in, snapped Josh, barely restraining the aggression. I've no intention of wimping out. That's why Joshy's our hero, said Jolie with an enormous supportive smile. Mark my words, he'll be the last man standing. Ah, Jolie. All right, well, let's get on. Try to keep minutes from now on, all right? Okay, Paddy, can you just repeat what you were saying so everyone can take it in? Because I think what you said perfectly sums up the key decision we have to make now. Paddy's head shot up, and he fumbled through his notes. Well, basically, it's a question of what our real aims are. If it's to punish the perpetrators and educate the public, then, well, that involves one sort of approach, an attack directly on, the person in question, said Paddy, flashing a nervous glance at Joshua. But if our interest is the animal itself, as I think it should be, then it's a question of an anti-campaign, and if that doesn't succeed, then the forceful release of the animal. Right, said Crispin hesitantly, unsure where the Crispin role of glory would fit into freeing one mouse. But surely the mouse in this case is a symbol, i.e., this guy's got a lot more of them in his lab, so we have to deal with the bigger picture. We need someone to bust in there. Well, basically, I think that's the mistake that OHNO make, for example, because they take the animal itself as simply a symbol, and to me that's absolutely the opposite of what fate is about. If this were a man trapped in a little glass box for 6 years, he wouldn't be a symbol, you know? And I don't know about you, but there's no difference between mice and men, you know, in my opinion. The gathered members of fate murmured their assent, because this was the kind of sentiments to which they routinely murmured assent. Crispin was miffed. Right, well, obviously, I didn't mean that, Paddy. I just meant there is a bigger picture here, just like choosing between one man's life and many men's lives, right? Point of order, said Josh, putting his hand in the air for a chance to make Crispin look stupid. Crispin glared. Yes, Joshy, said Jolie sweetly. Go on. It's just that there aren't any more mice. I mean, yeah, there are lots of mice, but he hasn't got any exactly like this one. It's an incredibly expensive process. He couldn't afford loads. Plus the press goaded him that if the future mouse died while on display, he could just secretly replace it with another. So he got cocky. He wants to prove that his calculations are correct in front of the world. He's only going to do one and barcode it. There are no others. Jolie beamed and reached down to massage Josh's shoulders. Right. Yes, well, I guess that makes sense. So, Paddy, I see what you're saying. It is a question of whether we're going to devote our attentions to Marcus Chalfen or to releasing the actual mouse from its captivity in front of the world's press. Point of order. Yes, Josh, what? Well, Crispin, this isn't like other animals you bust out. It won't make any difference. The damage is done. The mouse carries around its own torture in its genes, like a time bomb. If you release it, it'll just die in terrible pain somewhere else. Point of order. Yes, Paddy, go on. Well, basically, would you not help a political prisoner to escape from jail just because he had a terminal disease? The multiple heads of fate nodded vigorously. Yes, Paddy, yes, that's right. I think Joshua's wrong there, and I think Paddy has presented to us the choice we have to make. It's one we've come up against many times before, and we've made different choices in different circumstances. We have in the past, as you know, gone for the perpetrators. Lists have been made and punishments dealt out. Now, I know in recent years we have been moving away from some of our previous tactics, but I think even Jolie would agree this is really our biggest, most fundamental test of that. We are dealing with seriously disturbed individuals. Now, on the other side of things, we have also staged large-scale peaceful protests and supervised the release of thousands of animals held captive by this state. In this case, we just won't have the time or opportunity to employ both strategies. It's a very public place and, well, we've been over that. As Paddy said, I think the choice we have on the 31st is quite simple. It's between the mouse and the man. Has anyone got any problem with taking a vote on that? Joshua? Joshua sat on his hands to lift himself up and give Jolie better purchase on his upper back massage. No problem at all, he said. On the 20th of December, at precisely 00:00 hours, the phone rang in the Joneses' house. Irie shuffled downstairs in her nightdress and picked up the receiver. I would like you yourself to make a mental note of both the date and the time when I have chosen to ring you. What? What? Is that Ryan? Look, Ryan, I don't mean to be rude, but it's midnight, yeah? Is there something you wanted? Or, Irie, Pickney, you there? Your grandmother is on the telephone extension. She wished to talk to you also. Irie, said Hortense excitably. You gonna have to speak up. Me can't hear nothing. Irie, I repeat. Have you noted the date and the time of our call? What? Look, I can't. I'm really tired. Could this wait until the 20th, Irie? At 00:00 hours, twos and zeros. You're listening, Pickney. Mr. Tupp's trying to explain something very important. Gran, you're going to have to talk one at a time. You just hauled me out of bed. I'm like totally knackered. Twos and zeros, Miss Jones, signifying the year 2000. And do you know the month of my call? Ryan, it's December. Is this really the 12th month, Irie, corresponding to the 12 tribes of the children of Israel, of which each was sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Judah was sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Reuben was sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Ryan, I get the picture. There are certain days when the Lord wishes us to act, certain pre-warning days, designated days, where we must be saving the souls of the lost, warning them ahead of time. We are warning you, Irie. Hortense began softly weeping. We are only trying to warn you, darling. Okay, great. I stand warned. Good night, all. That is not the end of our warning, said Ryan solemnly. That is simply the first warning. There are more. Don't tell me. 11 more. Oh, cried Hortense, dropping the phone but still distantly audible. She have been visited by the Lord. She know before she be told. Look, Ryan, could you somehow condense the other 11 warnings into one? Or at least tell me the most important one. Otherwise, I'm afraid I'm going to have to go back to bed. There was a silence for a minute. Then, very well. Do not get involved with this man. Oh, Irie, please listen to Mr. Tupps. Please listen to him. With what man? Oh, Miss Jones, please do not pretend you have no knowledge of your great sin. Open your soul. Let the Lord, let myself reach out for yourself and wash you free of... Look. I'm really fucking tired. What man? The scientist, Chalfant, the man you call friend, when in truth he is an enemy of all humanity. Marcus? I'm not involved with him. I just answer his phone and do his paperwork. And thus are you made the secretary of the devil, said Ryan, prompting Hortense into more and louder tears. Thus is you yourself laid low. Ryan, listen to me. I haven't got time for this. Marcus Chalfant is simply trying to come up with some answers to shit like cancer, okay? I don't know where you've been getting your information, but I can assure you he ain't the devil incarnate. Only one of her minions, protested Hortense. Only one of them frontline troops. Calm yourself, Mrs. B. I'm afraid your granddaughter is too far gone for us. As I expected, since leaving us, she's joined the dark side. Fuck you, Ryan. I'm not Darth Vader. Grant... Don't talk to me, Pickney. Don't talk to me. I is bitterly disappointed. It appears we will be seeing you on the 31st then, Miss Jones. Stop calling me Miss Jones, Ryan. What? The 31st. The event will provide a platform for the witness message. The world's press will be there, and so will we. We intend to... We gwan wan all of them, broke in Hortense. And we got it all planned nice, see? We gone sing hymns with Mrs. Dobson on the accordion, cause you can't shift a piano all the way there. And we gone hunger strike until that heaven man stop messing with the Lord's beauteous creation and... Hunger strike? Gran, when you go without 11Zs, you get nauseous. You've never gone without food for more than 3 hours in your life. You're 85. You forget, said Hortense with chilling curtness. I was born in strife. Me a survivor. A little no food don't frighten me. And you're going to let her do that, are you, Ryan? She's 85, Ryan. 85. She can't go on a hunger strike. I'm telling you, Irie, said Hortense, speaking loudly and clearly into the mouthpiece. I want to do this.